Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Look, the new Trump strategy is becoming glaringly obvious. Stonewall Congress refused to honor subpoenas, refused to turn over tax returns, blocked the testimony of investigators and witnesses, including special counsel Robert Mueller and former White House counsel Don McGahn. Well, until a few days ago, it was assumed that Mueller would testify, and he still might. Attorney General Bill Barr said he had no objection to that, but Trump over the weekend abruptly changed direction, tweeting out and giving interviews explaining his opposition to Mueller testifying. And now the White House is saying it's blocking McGahn's testimony, claiming executive privilege. All of this comes as the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, flatly refuses to comply with a subpoena from the House Ways and Means Committee for Trump's tax returns. Look, this is not a president who's a stranger to obstruction, but his pivot still feels like an inflection point, and Republicans in Congress seem to be all in. On Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell took to the floor of the Senate to say that the case was closed on the Mueller report.
Yet on this central question, the special counsel's finding is clear. Case closed. Case closed. This ought to be good news for everyone. But my Democratic colleagues seem to be publicly working through the five stages of grief. Our colleagues across the aisle want to shoot the messenger and keep the perpetual outrage machine right on going. Even undermining the institution of the Attorney General itself in the process.
Well, apparently that's the new party line among Republicans, at least for the time being, is they're all falling in line behind Trump's demand the investigation is over. There's nothing more to see. There's nothing more to hear. Meanwhile, the House seems poised to find the Attorney General in contempt for refusing to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. So this seems to be the word of the day, contempt. Both legal and political, as Trump seems to be almost daring Congress to impeach him. And that's what Nancy Pelosi is saying. Yesterday, she said that it was almost as if Trump was trying to goad them into impeaching him. Well, on today's podcast, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to break it into two parts with two guests, looking at how this story is playing out on Capitol Hill with Washington Post congressional reporter Rachel Bade. But first, we're going to talk about the legal and the constitutional issues here with law professor and Bulwark contributor Kim Whaley, who joins me now. Kim, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Well, let's just start with this. Are we heading toward a, we've used this term many, many times, but are we now really heading toward a constitutional clash, a constitutional crisis, or what would you characterize it as?
I think we've been in a constitutional crisis. It depends how you define the word crisis. But if we define it as the coordinate branches of government are not functioning, I think that's where we are. And we've been that way for a while. Let me explain. You know, the framers of the Constitution basically split up a monarchy into three pieces. Instead of one person being the boss, we have the president, we have the Congress, and we have the judiciary, with the idea that each of them check the other branch. So there's almost three heads of state, a three-headed monster, so to speak. But of course, historically, presidents have basically played ball. They've turned over tax returns, they've complied with congressional subpoenas, and maybe making some noises, but not an all-out no. I mean, think about President Nixon when there was an order from the Supreme Court through the federal courts to turn over the tapes, which ultimately led to his downfall as president. He complied. And we're in a world where even if a court order were to come down, I don't think any of us can be 100% sure that this president would say that's a legitimate court and it can tell me what to do. So it's a standoff right now. And if there aren't pushbacks, if there aren't guardrails, if there aren't consequences for violating laws and norms, even if that's a norm of civility that is inherent in the separation of powers, then we could cascade to something worse, like an autocracy. And I would say that's a crisis.
Well, there's been this mantra from people saying, okay, as bad as people thought it was, as much as people were afraid of this, our institutions have held up pretty well. Our norms are really intact. And I have sort of the feeling that fight is just beginning for exactly the reasons you said. And let's go to this question of contempt, the word contempt. So let's say, for example, Congress does hold Bill Barr in contempt. What does that actually mean? It comes to the question of you have three branches of government. One branch of government you know, challenges another branch of government. How do they enforce that? What are the actual weapons in the armory of the Democrats or of the House of Representatives?
Okay, so contempt would be like a citation. So you might get a parking ticket, right? It's on the windshield of your car. If you throw it in the trash, you know they'll find you. They'll put the boot on your car, or what, you know, there's going to be some consequence where the city will follow you until you pay, and then the fines will triple, and there are consequences for that. So the question with contempt is, it's a citation. It's a piece of paper where Congress says we're holding you in contempt, and the next question is, where's the boot on the car? There are three options. One is, in theory, Congress could call its sergeant of arms to actually put the person who's non-complying in jail. I don't know if there's even a jail, frankly, in Congress, but theoretically they have that power. That's not going to happen. Number two would be to enforce it through the criminal laws.
Okay, let's go back. The first option is technically they could imprison this person who is flouting the subpoena. You mean, I get it, it's inconceivable, but it's there.
Yeah, they technically
could lock him up.
They could arrest him. Through the power of Congress presumably there would be a court battle, right? This is one other norm or law or standard that has not been pressed and pushed. So I can't say that whoever was actually arrested by the sergeant of arms of Congress would not have good claims in court that he or she would move to quash that or basically seek some kind of relief from a court, probably. And I'm not sure how that would play out, but sure. Historically, that is there.
Okay, let's stipulate that that is not likely to happen. So number two, they have three options. What's number two?
Number two would be to enforce it through the criminal laws. And, the difference between a criminal law and a civil law is a violation of a criminal law can put you in jail. A violation of a civil law, a slip and fall at Starbucks, could make you pay money. So the enforcement of the criminal laws at the federal level happens through the Department of Justice. Guess who's in charge of the Department of Justice? Bill Barr, and his boss is the president. So the president could say, Congress, we're not going to enforce your contempt citation. We choose to ignore that, which I think under the circumstances is 100% possibility or virtually guarantee that if Congress went to President Trump and said, please enforce my citation against you, he'd say no. So that's out.
That's also not going to happen. Okay, number three.
Correct. Number three would be for Congress to file a civil action. As I mentioned, a civil action is any other sort of regular dispute where you could get either what's called an injunction, a court order telling you to do something or not do something, or money damages. Here, Congress would file a lawsuit in the court and say, I want a court order forcing, basically directing the recipient of the subpoena to comply. So then we'd have two citations or two orders, so to speak. We'd have the original contempt citation from Congress saying you must comply with my subpoena, and you did not, so here's your contempt citation. And then we'd have a court order saying you must comply with the contempt citation. But of course, we'd be in the same boat once again. It all comes down to enforcing the court order. Presumably, someone like Don McGahn or even Bill Barr would comply with that. I don't know where President Trump would stand on that, to be perfectly honest with you. It's hard to tell.
Okay. So I think there's actually a podcast called, Can He Do That? So let's go through this. Can Trump do this? Can Trump actually, does he have the power to block Bob Mueller from testifying in front of the House of Representatives or the Senate?
Maybe I'm not sure if he's a private citizen yet. Once Bob Mueller is a private citizen, he doesn't have any control over what Bob Mueller does. I would presume if Bob Mueller got an order from a court saying that he has to show up in Congress, he would comply. Now, remember, back to my other point, how do you enforce a court order? That would be the U.S. Marshal. The U.S. Marshal would arrest someone for not complying with a court order. This happened to Susan McDougal in the Whitewater investigation that I worked on. She wouldn't comply with an order to appear before the grand jury. She went to jail. Of course, the Marshal Service also answers to the President of the United States. All these things are kind of insidiously wrapped up. But Mueller could do what it looks like Don McGahn is doing and saying, wait a minute, I don't want to get in the middle of this fray. I'm going to sit back and see where things shake out because I'm getting directive from the president that I want to respect because I respect norms saying not testify. I'm getting a directive from Congress saying I must testify. I don't know which master is my master right now. But to answer your original question, President Trump doesn't have any control over Bob Mueller, what he says now, if once he's a private citizen. He could assert executive privilege, but it doesn't look like that would certainly not give him a blanket protection from any testimony. I think that's a bit of a myth. Executive privilege would be a topic by topic privilege, not a blanket privilege. You cannot testify about anything because of executive privilege. That it doesn't work that way.
Okay, so can you block Don McGahn? Now, Don McGahn is, of course, a private citizen. So Don McGahn is waiting to see how this plays out. Who ultimately makes the decision?
Well, I think the decision would be ultimately first made by Don McGahn, and then it would be who enforces the consequences of that decision. If Don McGahn said, no, I'm not going to testify, then I think there would be a contempt citation, presuming there's an underlying subpoena. And I doubt Don McGahn wants to be involved in being held in contempt of Congress or ultimately contempt of court. If he goes and does testify, the president, obviously, you know, we all know the way he pushes back on people is through his tweets and his bully pulpit. And it really does mean bullying. Don McGahn did cooperate with Robert Mueller, and I think the president has been public about disputing the accuracy of what he testified to or told Bob Mueller. So it's really up to Don McGahn. I don't think if he does testify, the president would have legal leverage to stop him from actually showing up.
You point out in the piece you wrote for The Bulwark that Trump, the president, has not abandoned his brass knuckle litigation tactics honed as Trump, the businessman. I think that's a really interesting insight, because you can certainly imagine the president sitting there in the Oval Office, and he's sitting behind the desk, and basically the strategy is F him. Just F him, you know, make him go to court, see if they can make me obey. And that seems to be the blanket strategy. Is there any part of you that is still capable of being surprised by Mitch McConnell and the other Republicans basically being all okay with this?
Well, yes, because I think Trump, you know, gets a lot of the heat for his aberrant behavior. Someone just explained it who allegedly worked with him at some point before he was in government, that it's like a toddler in a high chair with two fists of spaghetti, and every mom and grandma and auntie are all standing there saying, and dad, don't throw the spaghetti, right? And the kid throws the spaghetti. And then the question is, what are you going to do about that, right? If you're going to put the kid in a timeout, if you don't have a consequence, he's going to keep throwing the spaghetti. And I think that's where Trump is right now. He's just going to keep throwing the spaghetti. And if there's no stopping it should be the Congress. You know, the DOJ memo that says you can't indict a president means there's no accountability through the judicial process for a president, any president, for wrongdoing in office. So it has to be done in the legislative branch if we are going to have an accountable government, if we are going to have everyone in office actually answer to the people and not to themselves, essentially. And the Republicans are abdicating their constitutional responsibility for the sake of amassing, I don't know inside, but it seems like for the sake of amassing power across the board, amassing power through the judicial branch, amassing, you know, the Senate is the gatekeeper to judicial appointments, the gatekeeper to cabinet level appointments, the gatekeeper to legislation. They can say no too. And it is not an ineffective strategy. There has to be a stop to it somewhere.
You know, I do like your image of the kid being in the high chair and throwing the spaghetti. But I always think of the Twilight Zone episode where there's this young bratty kid and everybody's afraid to make him mad because terrible things will happen. I think there's a little bit of that. So
it's toxic spaghetti. Yeah.
It is very toxic spaghetti. So you described the president's strategy as this bare knuckles legal strategy. Are the Democrats engaging in a bare knuckle legal strategy? Have they figured out what they need to do to push back against a president who's basically saying, yeah, F him. I'm not giving him anything. I'm going to fight everything. I'm going to go so far as to file a lawsuit blocking Deutsche Bank from cooperating with a House investigation.
Yeah, that's stunning if you actually read the complaint, which I did, which says they want a permanent, that is the Trump family, wants a permanent injunction from the federal court banning and barring banks from complying with the subpoena from the Congress. A permanent injunction means forever and ever and ever. And as I've said, if that injunction is issued and goes all the way to the Supreme Court pursuant to the Constitution, it's set in stone. There's no way to change that except by an amendment to the Constitution. I can't say, Charlie, that the House or, you know, the Democrats in Congress are in that brass knuckle moment. I think it seems like politically when they step into that fray, they get attacked for being too tough or overreaching. We saw this starting, I think, in the Obama administration when Mitch McConnell wouldn't bring Merrick Garland's nomination to the floor at all for the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, under Article 2 of the Constitution, the president has the power to appoint. That is his constitutional right. The majority leader in the Senate doesn't get to sort of use internal rules to block that. But, Obama let it happen, right? So he could have just said, I'm appointing him. Your advice and consent is tomorrow by 3 o'clock. If I don't get an objection, I'm going to assume under the Constitution that's advice and consent and seat him on the court. That's the kind of brass knuckle tactics that we're in right now.
That might have ended badly as well.
Sure. Yeah. I don't endorse that, but it is very difficult for people that like to follow norms or respect norms to figure out how to play in the way Mr. Trump is playing.
That's right. And of course, there's a whole school of thought now on the part of the Democrats is that, you know, forget about the norms, forget about those rules. We need to behave like they are behaving. Okay, one other issue, a legal issue that I touched on earlier, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who was, by the way, the finance chairman of Trump's campaign, is basically saying, yeah, forget it. We're not giving you Trump's taxes, even though, and I'm not the lawyer here, the law seems to be very explicit that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee has the power to compel the IRS to give him those tax returns. And basically the Treasury Department is saying, yeah, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, this is another separation of power showdown. I mean, I read you the language of the tax code section 6103F1. Upon written request of the chairman of the Committee on Ways and Means of the House of Representatives, the Secretary of Treasury shall furnish such committee with any return or return information specified in such request. It doesn't make it contingent on proof that it's a legitimate legislative purpose. This is a 95-year-old law. So essentially, Mnuchin is saying, I'm flouting not just this request, but I'm flouting a statute. I'm not going to comply with a law that was duly passed by the Congress of the United States.
Are they suggesting that the law itself is unconstitutional?
I think that's what, if this goes to court, they're going to have to make that argument.
Yeah,
they're going to have to make the argument that the law itself is not constitutional, needs to, or if it's not constitutional, it needs to be read in a way that doesn't render it constitutional. That is, that you'd have to justify that there's a legislative objective. But even that, the Supreme Court has said that legislative objective is pretty broad. I'll read to you from a case from 1975. The issuance of a subpoena pursuant to an authorized investigation is an indispensable ingredient of lawmaking. Without it, our recognition that the act of authorizing is protected would be meaningless. So the court, at least the court in 1975, understood that without some process for investigating and gathering information, the Congress is hamstrung. The Congress can't function. And if we knock out one leg of the stool, then we have a powerful president, and that baton can pass to any political party. A religious ideologue for those who can't imagine a sort of scenario that is not consistent with their own beliefs. Once that power amasses in the presidency, it's there for the taking. And I, for one, for my children and grandchildren, want to have a fair system.
Well, because I love these historical deep dives, it's worth reminding people this particular law about the tax returns goes back to the Teapot Dome scandal, which is the 1920s under President Harding, and a big feud between members of Congress and Andrew Mellon, who was the very deep pocketed Secretary of Treasury at the time. And it's interesting that really historically you go from Teapot Dome was the big scandal. It was sort of the Watergate of its time. And so, you know, until Watergate, that was the one. So you go from Teapot Dome to Watergate to what we have right now. And of course, nobody remembers any of these things anymore, but each one sets a very, very significant precedent, and it does change our norms, and it does change this balance of power between Congress and the president. And this is going to be an historically impactful scenario. I mean, how this plays out, I didn't put that well, but the precedent set by what the president is able to get away with and what Congress allows him to get away with, and whether the whether the courts want to get involved at all, because I'm guessing, and you write about this, the courts are going to be highly reluctant to step in between the two branches of government, aren't they?
Well, they have an out. It's called the political question doctrine. It's highly subjective. They can say, we don't want to weigh in on this, and then just leave it for the food fight. I do think when it comes to ignoring an act of Congress, it's like this particular tax code provision, I would be surprised if the court walks away from it. But not to just, you know, repeat myself, but I just say I'm not a legal historian. But the difference now is that we've got the president after 2 years of a investigation and all our national security intelligence agencies saying Russia attacked our election. We have a president having a phone call with Putin saying it was a hoax. I don't know that that was the case with Watergate. I don't know that that was the case with the Teapot Dome scandal, where we have a situation where one of our historical arch enemies, right, one of the three axes of evil under our last Republican president, George W. Bush, is basically dictating the narrative of our own president when it comes to the attack on our electoral process, and the president's going along with it.
I'm really glad that you brought this up, because to a certain extent, you know, we can, just for the sake of argument, we can debate, did the president actually, you know, break the law or betray his country during the campaign, leaving aside what happened in the past. What's happening right now is itself a scandal. It is taking place in real time, in broad daylight. The president of the United States, who's been told over and over again that this is an ongoing attack on the United States, essentially, you know, gives a wink and a nod to Vladimir Putin. Once again, like he did at Helsinki, is the investigation, the investigators in the intelligence community under the bus, you know, in a private conversation with a thug like Vladimir Putin. We're going into the 2020 election with a federal government that is not necessarily prepared to deal with it, and a president who is not going to be rallying the troops. So that is an ongoing scandal itself, but given everything else, it almost doesn't register, does it?
Well, and it should. I mean, he's not even just wink and nod. He's saying it's a hoax. To me, that's fake. That means it's made up. It's total speculation. It's fake news or whatever. It's not. It's real. And this is back to Mitch McConnell. I know. I mean, he's very careful on his statement today to use the word conspiracy. But to your point, that's beside the point. I want my vote to matter. I don't want Putin, the puppeteer, managing our electoral process. And if the commander in chief is denying that the sky is blue, that's a problem. That's a problem for every American who wants to have their vote matter. It really is.
It is a huge problem. Look, thanks for joining me. Kim Whaley is a professor of law, former assistant U.S. attorney, member of the Whitewater Investigatory Team. And her new book, How to Read the Constitution, is going to be coming out next month. Looking forward to seeing it. We'll have you back and talk about it. So again, Kim, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very, very much.
So happy to be here, Charlie.
Thank you. This is a good time to remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or just check us out on our homepage, which is thebulwark.com. So how is all of this playing out on Capitol Hill? How are the Democrats reacting, and what are they going to do about it? What can they do about it? We're joined by Rachel Bade, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, who makes a return to this podcast. Well, actually, Rachel, not a return to this podcast, because you were on the Daily Standard podcast, but we sort of think of this as the successor to that. So welcome back. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, happy to be on.
Okay, so how are the Democrats on Capitol Hill reacting to the news that the White House is barring former White House counsel Don McGahn from complying with that subpoena?
Oh, they're absolutely furious, and I feel like that's sort of a constant state of their emotions right now over the past few weeks, as we've seen the White House just stonewall the House Democratic investigations over and over again, whether it's the tax returns, now with Don McGahn. They wanted to bring the former White House counsel to the Hill, put him on the witness stand, and basically have him tell his story that he told Mueller about Trump trying to get him to fire the special counsel, and, you know, this was one of the main potential instances of obstruction of justice that Mueller looked into. And the problem is the White House is now asserting executive privilege and saying that McGahn cannot turn over documents. That deadline was today at 10 o'clock. And the interesting thing here is Democrats were hoping and had been sort of talking privately over the past couple weeks that they thought maybe he would comply, even if the White House asserts executive privilege. There's sort of a weird legal argument going back and forth about whether they already waived it. And if so, maybe Don McGahn would work with them anyway. Well, McGahn, his lawyer, has basically said he's going to sit back and let the White House and the House Democrats duke it out, try to find an agreement. Let's be honest, they won't. And this will end up in court.
So I'm a little bit puzzled here, and I'm not the lawyer here. I guess I'm unclear. Can the White House invoke executive privilege in some circumstances but not others? Because my understanding was that they waived executive privilege when they were dealing with Robert Mueller, but now they're saying that, no, they're going to reinvoke it for Congress?
So to be clear, I'm not a lawyer either, but I have made many calls to former House counsels on this very question, started doing it yesterday. So that's the main legal question right now. Typically, when you waive executive privilege on something, you waive it. But the White House last week sort of laid out this new legal argument where they said, oh, you know, we waived it so McGahn and other aides could work with Mueller or testify to Mueller, but not to Congress. And so that will be one of the main questions, I think, that, you know, when this heads to the courts, the judges will have to decide. A lot of former House counsels have told me they think this is sort of bogus, that the White House could claim executive privilege on anything maybe that McGahn told Mueller that didn't make the final cut of the report, but that Congress, since this report is out there in public, has a right to bring McGahn in and question him on this stuff. And so that's sort of the big question right now.
So earlier on the podcast, when we were talking with Kim Whaley, we were talking about Trump trying to block or saying that they didn't want Robert Mueller to testify. And of course, one of the key questions is, does Robert Mueller work for the Department of Justice or is he a private citizen? If he's a private citizen, he can do whatever he likes. Don McGahn is a private citizen. So, you know, what possible grounds would they have to block him from testifying about things that he's already talked about? Again, it's sort of a different way of stating right. The same question.
It's a great question. And, you know, that's the thing. Like, everybody is saying that this is up to McGahn. Like, who does he believe? Which legal argument is he going to side with? If he agrees with the White House and goes with them, the Democrats will hold him in contempt, probably. TBD on that, of course. And then take him to court. But there's a possibility that he could ignore them, say this is a bogus legal argument. I'm going to comply with a congressional subpoena because I don't want to be held in contempt of Congress. Now, remember, this, he's a young guy. He still has a years in the private sector, and maybe he doesn't want to be held in contempt. And in that situation, I'm told the White House would have to sue him to get him to stop and try to go to a judge to basically prevent him from turning over documents or testifying. So it really depends on, you know, what he decides.
Interesting little twist here, because I noticed that you retweeted Robert Costa, your colleague, who also has a byline on your story on all of this, that one thing to remember about all of this is that Don McGahn was always in the executive privilege camp in Trump world, and he was actually frustrated with Dowd and Cobb over their legal strategy, which was to cooperate with Robert Mueller. So this is kind of an interesting twist there, that philosophically he's got a record of kind of being the guy, don't give him the papers, and it really wasn't his call, right?
That's right. But that was, you know, before he started working with Mueller and, like, telling Mueller exactly what had happened or transpired between him and the president. You know, once that happens, it would be interesting to hear his take now. But back then it was, well, if you force me to do this, you're going to screw us over. And, you know, now they're in this position where, you know, he's facing either being accused of turning on the president, somebody he worked for 2 years, or being held in contempt of Congress and having that be like this black splotch on his resume for the rest of his professional career. So he's in a bad spot.
Well, as you pointed out, you know, the next few couple of weeks are going to be kind of wild. I mean, in the House of Representatives, when it comes to these investigations, you have the possibility of Mueller testifying. We don't know. Contempt citations for the Attorney General Bill Barr. This whole question about whether or not Don McCain is going to testify. And you described him as absolutely furious about it. Is there a sense among the Democrats that even though they are outraged about this, that ultimately Trump might get away with this, that there's not much they actually can do about it if in fact he decides to go full Stonewall?
I do think, you know, people are upset and maybe a little depressed by how these investigations are going to be blocked and could potentially be stalled up in the courts for months, if not years. But I, you know, when you talk to them, a lot of the Dems on the Hill believe they will ultimately be successful. And, you know, you even can talk to some Trump folks privately who think some of these legal arguments the Trump White House is making, that they're not going to hold up. But that's not the point. The point for them is to slow these investigations, to drag this out past 2020. And so the question here is, can Democrats find a way to speed all this up so that they can get rulings quickly and can continue their investigations and sort of laying out all the scandal of the White House before 2020, which is what they ultimately want to do. But on the merits, you know, I think a lot of them, and I think I've talked to a lot of Republican lawyers who think the Democrats will be successful. It's just a timing issue here, but that's still a big problem for them.
Nancy Pelosi had something interesting to say yesterday. She said that it was almost, I don't know whether she said, used the word almost as if, but she said Trump is trying to goad us into impeaching him. This seemed by showing this much overt contempt for Congress, and it's legal and political contempt for Congress, that he's trying to poke the bear. What do you think about that? I mean, and what is Pelosi thinking about all this? Is she, you know, she's been holding the line. Let's not go to impeachment yet. Let's, you know, try to do it step by step. Is she feeling that Trump is trying to force her hand? And is that actually what's happening in the rank and file or than the leadership?
Yeah, it's such an interesting dynamic right now. I feel like in the past couple weeks with all the stonewalling we've seen from the White House, there's really been a change in sentiment among the rank and file in the House under Pelosi. A lot of them have always said, you know, we follow Pelosi. She's our fearless leader. And she has a lot of power over her caucus. But privately last week, you know, I started to hear some people who were always skeptics of impeachment and more than willing to follow Pelosi start to say, wait a second, we can't just allow the president to get away with this. This is going to totally upend, you know, checks and balances, the separation of power, undercut Congress's authority from now on if we don't impeach him. So, you know, her rank and file members are starting to talk about this more and more. But Pelosi really maintains that, like you just quoted, that Trump is doing this on purpose, that he thinks it's going to be a political win for him, and frankly, he does. And she worries about the political blowback of them impeaching the president. And it doesn't seem, we saw her increase her rhetoric or sharpen her rhetoric last week. She compared Trump to Nixon. She accused the Attorney General, Bill Barr, of lying to Congress and committing a crime. But when it comes to impeachment, she hasn't really shifted, and she still has that fear. So, you know, it's just sort of this awkward dynamic where, you know, she has always had this power over her caucus. That's really going to be tested, I think, in the next few weeks, especially if we continue to see the White House moves down this path of obstructing any congressional investigations. It's really angering people. But Pelosi is trying to find any argument to say, look, Trump wants us to do this. We can't do this. It's going to hurt us in the long run.
Are you into Game of Thrones?
I totally am. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, there's been kind of a narrative of goading someone into making an ill-advised attack. Have you noticed this? Where some evil figure will kill a beloved character right in front of somebody to goad them into it. Jon Snow did it. No spoiler alerts. You know, happened in the most recent episode. I do kind of think
well,
of this as the
don't tell me, because I haven't seen the most
okay,
recent
I'm talking,
episode.
Okay,
I'm,
fair enough.
Okay.
Okay, so we will talk about it afterwards. So we haven't asked this question for some time. Among Republicans, you know, I'm watching the president absolutely stonewall a co-equal branch of government, and I am not seeing any indication that there are any Republicans that are objecting to any of these tactics at this point. which seems like an old story, but it's still, there is the institutional pride issue, but there's nothing. I mean, Republicans are all in on this strategy, aren't they?
It's yes. Well, it's funny because I just ran into Jeff Flake in the hallway and I asked him about this and he was like, of course I'm concerned. This is terrible for the institution of Congress. I'm like, well, why don't you see more of your colleagues saying something like this? And he's like, this is the same old, you know, where they don't criticize the president, which is something Jeff Flake, who, you know, is now a retired senator, who always spoke up and out against the president, basically saying his colleagues are afraid to check Trump on this. And that is what I've seen up here. Every single Republican I have talked to has said Democrats are trying to conduct some sort of witch hunt against the president, and that this is all, you know, they're totally behind him. But listen, like I came here, when I came here about a decade ago, I guess it's less than a decade ago, so one of my first assignments was to cover the IRS scandal, this controversy that we saw percolating when Obama was in the White House, and the Republican-controlled House did depositions with IRS officials, accused them of treating conservative groups differently, adversely. They investigated the Benghazi attack, called in a whole bunch of White House officials for depositions, got a whole bunch of documents. And so this notion that, you know, Republicans are saying, oh, this is typical. There's always a tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Yes, that's true. But for the president to say, I am going to block all the subpoenas, we are not going to give you anything, that is unprecedented. And it is going to have an effect on, you know, when we see a Democrat in the White House and Republicans controlling Congress, that's a question of when, not a question of if. Someday that will happen. What sort of effect does Trump's strategy right now have on Congress and their ability to do oversight over of a Democratic president in the future? I just don't. They're totally ignoring that. They're thinking short. They're thinking of the short term, not of the long term. But this is going to undercut them, no doubt about it.
Dramatically, and that term unprecedented has been used over and over again. And I always try to find what is the historical precedent. Well, you know, Richard Nixon pushed back and said he's not going to cooperate anymore, but not the sort of global stonewall that we're having right now. What did you think of Mitch McConnell's speech? What kind of reaction is there on Capitol Hill to Mitch McConnell deciding to basically say, nothing more to see here, nothing more to investigate, the Mueller report is case closed?
It's the partisan reaction that you know, would expect. Democrats are saying, oh my gosh, look at this, he's turning a blind eye to, you know, the president undercutting Congress's power. Pelosi and Schumer put out a statement basically criticizing him. And then other Republicans are falling in line. I just talked to Rand Paul in one of the Senate hallways a couple minutes ago. And, you know, he always talks about the Constitution and the framers and the founders of our country. And I was like, are you at all concerned about this? And his response was no. And he quickly pivoted to the Democrats asking for Trump's tax returns and made a sort of an interesting point about how if they do that for Trump, you know, it's going to open a Pandora's box. And from now on, we're going to see the Congresses request the tax returns of political donors, political candidates, and ask for all this information. And it's going to set a bad precedent. I did think that was kind of interesting. But I also expected him to sort of speak up about, you know, all the other stonewalling we're seeing. That's one example of maybe like eight different things.
Yeah, I've just said before that I've gotten used to being disappointed, but I mean, this has really become the pattern. And I suppose the one part of it that still surprises me is you would think that there'd be some just sort of lingering sense of institutional prerogatives that should not be easily surrendered. You know, even at the peak of his power, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, encountered independent Democrats in the United States Senate when he tried to pack the U.S. Supreme Court, for example. There were people who go, no, we're not going to let you do that. That whole tradition of independence seems to be lost, although, you know, if I say that I'm really, really surprised by Rand Paul not actually standing on principle, I would be I would not be telling you the truth.
But I mean, it's also interesting to see, though, you know, one of my colleagues who covers the Justice Department just sent me all this information quoting a bunch of Republican former prosecutors who are speaking up against this. And so there's, you know, it's not all Republicans. It's
no, elected
specifically
officials.
Republicans, elected officials who know Trump has a very high approval rating and are concerned about being reelected. But, you know, we are seeing Republicans who are either retired or, you know, former federal prosecutors who worked for Republican administrations speak up and say this is not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. So over the weekend, we got the report that there were plans to have Robert Mueller testify on May 15th. Fair to say that that is no longer operative? Or do we just
you
not
know? I think it's a matter of time. You know, people sort of freaked out this weekend when Trump said he doesn't want Mueller to testify. But people, Republicans have really been sort of downplaying that. You know, Doug Collins, he's a Republican on the Judiciary Committee in the House. He even doubled down on his comments from a couple days ago saying, I want Mueller to come in and testify. We need him to come in and testify. And so at the same time, we've seen the Justice Department, they have actually been part of this whole behind-the-scenes negotiation with Mueller and with the Judiciary Committee to try to pick a day. So, you know, for them to all of a sudden change gears just because Trump doesn't want Mueller to appear, it would be, you know, it would be a tremendous flip-flop, number one. But number two, they would be undercutting any sort of legal argument they would have to make to try to justify keeping Mueller from the Hill, because they've said consistently it's fine that he appear. There is no executive privilege that can be asserted over Mueller or his testimony. So it seems like, you know, Trump is sort of backed into a corner on that specifically. I don't know what day he's going to come in, but I would be shocked if Mueller does not come testify at some point.
Which, of course, will be the high point for at least the next month, at least this extraordinary series of events that you described. Rachel Bade, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us again. Appreciate it very much.
Happy to be on anytime.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.